Today's episode is one of the reasons I started this podcast over 11 years ago, although I didn't know it at the time. I had never heard of my guest, Peter A. Levine, and I had no idea that this was going to be other than a sort of plant-based cooking show. But this episode features one of my intellectual isn't quite the big enough word, but one of my intellectual heroes, Peter Levine, who is the co-creator, the founder, really, of somatic experiencing, and probably one of the most important figures in 21st century Western modern scientific understanding of trauma and healing. And in his autobiography, which was just published the day we recorded this, which is, as I'm speaking, was yesterday, April 2nd, 2024, he reveals explicitly and publicly for the first time the deep spiritual underpinnings of this work, which has been sort of put into the scientific framework of neurobiology, of evolutionary biology. And in this conversation and in his book, we talk about shamanism, about Diné, Navajo healing rites, about Tibetan mysticism, about dreams and synchronicities and the understanding of the collective unconscious of Carl Jung. And as someone who has kind of dabbled in both sides, I never saw the depth of the spiritual work overtly. And so this was just a thrill and a delight to spend an hour with this person who has had such a profound influence upon me over the years. And I hope you enjoy it as well. Without further ado, so Dr. Peter Levine, welcome to the Plant Yourself podcast.
Plant Yourself, I like that.
Yeah, it's taken on many meanings.
I'll bet.
Over the years. So I have been wanting to talk to you for a long time. I first came across your work through reading Stephen Porges and Bessel van der Kolk, two folks that you graciously acknowledge in an autobiography of trauma.
Right.
So I want to talk, I've just, you know, read through the manuscript twice. I'm really excited to talk about it with you. But I think for the audience, probably for me, if you could start with everything, you know, everything that people knew about you before you wrote this autobiography, just sort of who you are and somatic experiencing and what the elevator speech journey has been.
Right. Well, I'm the developer of somatic experiencing, and this is something I began teaching in the late 60s, early 1970s, and it's an approach to healing the wounds of trauma and abuse. It's now taught in 44 different countries, I think. And about the autobiography, I started to write this about 3 years ago, and I had no intention of publishing it as a book. You know, I'm now at the age where I have certainly less time in the future that I've had in the past. And so I wanted to really kind of excavate my life, again, for my own purposes, it's kind of like a journal. And so I began with that. And then a very good friend of mine said, Peter, you really should write this as a book. And at first I was just mortified. I couldn't imagine the possibility of publishing something so vulnerable, so personal. She said, well, why don't you think about it? And so I did, and I felt conflicted. And often when I'm feeling conflicted, I'll wait for a dream or a synchronicity. And I had the following dream. I was standing at the edge of a large field, and I had in my hand two reams of paper. Obviously something was written on that was typewritten. And I looked to the left, and I looked to the right, left, right, and I couldn't make up my mind. And in that moment of indecision, A strong breeze came from behind me and took all of these papers and lifted them into the air to fall where they would in the meadow. And when I woke up, I realized that the decision had been made, that I was going to write this as a book and land may they where they may. My friend really thought that people who read this autobiography, they could it would help them in their own healing. And so I felt, at least I felt more permission than to write it. And if you can believe it, I'm looking on my computer and it is the 2nd of April, and this is the day, literally the day that it's been released, and it's now available wherever you get books. So that's really how I came about to writing the book. And it was not an easy task, believe me. I mean, it wasn't an easy task even to just write it as a personal memoir, but in really putting it out into the world, it took a lot. Well, it, like my life, I've had a lot of persistence in my life and a lot of courage in my life. So I kind of enlisted that courage to take the next step and then found a publisher. And so Inner Traditions is now the publisher of An Autobiography of Trauma, A Healing Journey. And here you and I are talking on the actual day of release of this book.
I'm honored. So there's a lot I'd love to follow up in that story, but the first thing that comes to me is I about 20 minutes ago I got a confirmation email, I guess from your publicist, who included a list of questions that people ask, and one of the first ones was about to talk about a dream that you had had, that you narrate in the you describe in the book, and I realized I had completely missed those. I mean, I read it and I saw, like, yes, okay, there was a dream about this, and there was a dream about the house, and the dream about it. But, like, I realized, like, I don't know why I completely, like, I took lots of notes. I had lots of things about, or things I wanted to talk to you about, and that was totally off my radar. And I found myself wondering just for myself, like, what that was about. And I think it's, like, I've never, like, I envied your portentous dreams, the numinous, and I found myself wondering, like, how do you get, how did, what do you, what's your theory of why these dreams come to you? Are you sort of tenderized by your own healing work? Is it, were you born with it? Could I develop this? Because I feel like, I wake up from a dream and it's like, singing raccoons or something that like makes no sense and seems to have no depth whatsoever. So I'm curious about like what I missed and what I could learn from that.
That is an interesting question. You have to take, for me, to take my dreams seriously, because this is not exactly how it is, but it's sort of something like this. If the unconscious knows that you're serious about connecting with her, then dreams will tend to come. And I always carry with me to my bed a pad and a pen. And so, and even if I don't remember much about the dream, if I just say foggy, strange, at least the unconscious knows that I'm serious about connecting with her, with that inner goddess. And then in doing that and doing that as a practice, it became more and more apparent. And not only dreams, nocturnal dreams, but what I call what not what I call what Carl Jung calls synchronicities, coincidences, but they're co-incidences, and they also have great importance when we pay attention to them. And I think without that, I wouldn't have been able to write the book, certainly in the way that I did. And also, some dreams have been life-changing. And for example, when I was beginning to develop the work in the ninth, well, in the 70s and then in the early 1980s, I had the following dream. And in the dream, I'm in a room with this some kind of a spiritual teacher. He's in a black robe with purple sashes coming over and down to his feet. And I recognize him again as some kind of an important figure for me. And he hands me a box, a wooden box with a metal binding around the girth, which when I woke from the dream, I realized was the box that I, from my childhood story of Treasure Island. It was a treasure box. And without telling me this in words, I knew that he wanted me to take this box and take it through a door, and that door opened to another room. And at the far side of that other room, there was a safe, like a cast iron safe. And again, I realized that it was my assignment to open that safe and put the box in. So, and that was the dream. When I awoke, I thought, that is the stupidest dream. That makes no sense at all. And usually, when I say something like that about a dream, I haven't paid attention because dreams like this just don't show up and then they don't mean anything. I mean, even ones that seem like they don't mean anything, when we kind of explore them deeper, they do. So, anyhow, I realized that it had been my task to take this knowledge, which really is the root of somatic experiencing, but comes from a lineage over centuries, maybe over millennia, of wisdom that has come from different parts of the world. And so, as part of this task, I had the opportunity to meet with a Tibetan Lama in Berkeley. And long story of how I happened to find him or how he found me. But anyhow, he invited me over to his house in Berkeley. And I, knocked on the door, and one of his students opened the door, and the Lama poured some tea for me, and we both drank a cup of tea together. And he asked me why I came to see him. So I tried to explain to him the basis of my work of somatic experiencing. And I was curious if this is something that also appears in different Tibetan religions or Tibetan spiritual traditions. And he looked very interesting, and he said, "Well, I'm glad that you came. And what you're describing, yes, it's very similar to what's known in one of the Tibetan traditions called Kumnai, and it's a tantric body-oriented approach to healing." And so he mentioned that. He said, "But what we're talking about is a wisdom that has come from many different places throughout the world, and it probably had as its root the Stone Age religions of Scotland." And so after I spoke with him, of course, I ran to the Berkeley Library, to the university library, and I found a book that had pictures of Stone Age temples. And there was a very clear, and I have a picture of this in the book. There was a very, very, very clear, I don't know what you would call it, but a picture of one of these Stone Age temples. And there was an obelisk in the front of the door, the portal to the inner temple. And in order to enter that temple, you had to pass through that obelisk, that stone. And that they had vortexes spinning in both directions. They were carved into that rock. And that had been an important part in the development of my work. And so then it was absolutely clear that my job, as in the dream, was to put this ancient knowledge in safekeeping. And safekeeping meant that it would be appropriate or understood or spoke to people of the Western scientific psychological perspective, that this, that somatic experiencing, even though I seem to develop it out of nothing, clearly has its roots and deep, deep, deep roots. So again, as I followed these different dreams and getting messages, I think actually a dream before that, I don't remember if I mentioned that in the book, but and this occurred and must have been in the also around the time when I was beginning to develop the work. A man was driving in a Hudson 1948 Hudson convertible, and he was
Yeah,
riding
I think that's in the book as well, yes.
Okay, so anyhow, he's driving on the Hudson River, or as a boat, and he goes underneath the George Washington Bridge, and he yells up and says, "God, if you exist, give me a message, give me a sign." And in those days, there weren't turn signals on cars, so you had to use your hand to signal a turn or signal that you were stopping. But you could add something at the end, kind of like a extra kind of thing that you could put on this bottom of the steering column and connect to lights in the back of the car. And so as he's yelling to God, "Give me a signal," he doesn't realize that the left-hand turn signal is blinking green. And that was the sign, but he wasn't listening. And I realized so many times I wasn't listening when God, Goddess, had sent me a sign. And again, that really gave me more importance or more significance to taking my dreams seriously and synchronicity seriously. Because on my life, I've gotten many signs. Sometimes I've ignored them, and those have often been to my peril. But certainly, it's certainly been an important thing that I could have understood, but I wasn't again paying attention because the signal was happening. So again, those are some, and exactly why I had these relationships to dreams, I can't really tell you. My mother was extremely intuitive person. I mean, she in many ways was a very traumatic generating woman, but she was also quite intuitive. Let me give you another example of this, and this also was an important thing that I put in the book. And I was also a little bit afraid to even write about this. Well, I'll tell you why. So anyhow, when I was doing my doctoral work and developing somatic experiencing, this was in the early 70s, I guess, and my favorite restaurant on San Pablo Avenue in Berkeley was called A Beggar's Banquet. And I would often go there for my dinner. And they knew me well, and they greeted me by name.
I was wondering if that still exists.
It's not, I tried to find it. It doesn't exist. I think there's a restaurant by the same name, but it's in Wisconsin or something like that, or Michigan.
Okay.
And they always greeted me by name, and they would usually start my meal with a wonderful warm soup, along with some French bread that was like crispy on the outside and really soft and moist on the inside. And then I was in bliss. So I would have my soup, and then usually I would order a main course. So on one of these times, as I'm sitting at my usual table, I see a shadow coming from my left side. And I look up, and it's a man with wild, unkept hair and a suit that was probably two or three sizes too big. He looked like really quite disheveled. But I recognized the image as that of Albert Einstein. And, Jung also talks about these kind of are called, these inner images that sometimes appear to us like synchronicities. And so realizing that it's called, I think it's called active imagination. And he kind of motioned towards me, and I think he was planning to sit by me. And so I invited him to sit down. He introduced himself formally. And so began a year of conversations. And I would ask him questions related to my doctoral work or to the somatic experience which I was developing. And usually he would ask me questions about my questions, really kind of like the Socratic dialogue when you question and you question your questions. And so this went on, and it was tremendously, tremendously helpful and really brought my awareness into so many different areas that I developed and describe in my different books, starting with Waking the Tiger, but really in almost all of my books, and of course in the autobiography of trauma. So I think this is something that may find also interesting. Around that time, I had been working with a number of clients. I was developing a psychotherapy practice. And some of the people I was working with would report the smell of burning flesh. And a number of them were actually vegetarians, so that didn't really make a lot of sense. But I had a suspicion, and I asked them to talk to their parents or grandparents to find out more about what their life was like. Well, it turned out that a number of those had parents or grandparents that were survivors of the Holocaust or perished in the Holocaust, and that somehow they were smelling that of burning flesh. When I even mention that, I do feel choked up. And so I talked to my imagination of Einstein about that. And in a dr like with in a dream within a dream, he takes me to a pond, and he's holding a yardstick, and along the yardstick there are a number of small stones, and he holds them up over the pond and twists them, and the stones of course fall at the same speed, and when they hit the water, there are concentric rings of waves going out in all directions, forward, sideways, backwards. And then, again, in this sequence, Einstein shows me what happens, because if they're free to move, they'll just move in all directions and they'll intersect and continue to go out in waves. But if it gets stuck someplace, then everything after that also gets stuck. And he didn't say it in words, but I knew that's what he was talking about generational trauma. When there's something, an event like that, a cataclysmic event like the Holocaust, that these wave fronts get stuck and they're unable to pass in, coherently, but they break up and they become distorted. And I remember asking him, and I think this was about the last time we met, I said, Professor Einstein, can you tell me something about how to help people heal from these generational effects? And he said, Peter, I'm afraid that you'll have to find that out. I don't have an answer to that. And so, again, from the very beginning, I looked at not just what happens to people during this lifetime, but what may happen to other lifetimes, to lifetimes past, and also to things that have happened to their ancestors. Well, okay, so anyhow, I let that go. I ascribed it to active imagination, because as a scientist, I wasn't supposed to be, I mean, it would maybe even interfere with getting the work out if I talked about something which was so fanciful. So I let it go. But then, about 30 years ago, several decades after my conversations with Albert, I was visiting my parents in the Bronx in New York. And I was gone for the day downtown, going to different museums. And then I came back at the end, took the D train to 205th Street, walked up the hill, knocked on the door, opened the door, and my parents were sitting on the couch. And above the couch, there was a bookshelf. And I happened to notice that the theory of relativity was one of those books. So that prompted me to tell my parents, particularly my mother, about my previous encounters with Einstein. And my mother stood up straight and she said, "Peter, I know why that happened." And I said, "What?" And she said, "When I was 8 months pregnant with you, your father and I were canoeing on this lake, and a wind squall came up, tipped over tipped over the canoe, and they weren't able to right the canoe, and they certainly probably would have perished, and I wouldn't be doing this interview with you because I wouldn't be here." And at that moment of life threat for them and for me, a small sailboat came by, and there was an old man and a young woman, and they pulled my parents to safety. And they introduced themselves as Albert Einstein and his stepdaughter. And so, what I thought was just an imagination, I was just again stunned by my mother's admission that the reason I connected with Einstein was that we met in a time, he saved my life in a time of life threat. And because of that, we were eternally bonded. And not only those conversations, but at other times in my life, I've had kind of visitations from Einstein for different kinds of reasons. I don't think I think I talk about them in the book a little bit. But anyhow, again, these are these things that when I'm able to follow them and trust and not know where they're going to lead, they will lead somewhere and somewhere important. Think if my mother had, please.
Sorry. I mean, there's so much to unpack in the stories you've told, but I'll tell you the thing that like I'm listening and taking notes and agreeing and remembering what I read, but you used one word that kind of shook me a little when you said, in a nice way, you said the unconscious, and then you used the word her to refer to the unconscious. And so here I am, like I've just finished taking a course on sort of hypnosis and healing, trauma removal. And in that course, the unconscious is basically the survival drive, basically a 5-year-old. And when I think about that as an antecedent, I think about your work around helping people who have experienced trauma complete physical motions. And so I'm thinking in my mind that you also regard the unconscious as sort of the fight or flight drive, right? Like I'm in my mind, I'm seeing this incredible like 7-minute YouTube video of you working with an American serviceman who had a tic, right? And so in my mind, the unconscious is like, you know, the survival instinct, the fight or flight. And then you talk about her, and you talk about like the deep, like it's almost like the Jungian anima, which you mentioned. And now I'm all confused about the unconscious.
Excuse me, what way, Howie?
Well, just that I had read into your work this kind of very almost evolutionary psychology perspective. And I have to say, I was delighted and stunned to read about your encounters with shamans, with Hopi, with not with Diné, wise men, with the Tibetans, with psychedelics. And I'm like, oh, I can kind of see it in there now, but I had read in an unspoken voice and I didn't see any of it. And so I'd love to hear like what you think of as the unconscious, because it definitely has this sort of scientific, polyvagal, neurological aspect to it.
Sure.
And yet you use the word she, in a way that makes me think it's so much bigger.
Yeah, that is interesting, because when I think about the unconscious, it's more or less a feminine process, a feminine archetype. And I speak about many different instincts, the fight or flight. When I wrote Waking the Tiger, Healing Trauma, back in, I wrote it in 1992, finally got published in 96, I think. And I talked about these instincts, fight or flight, but also of freeze and collapse. And those are kind of biological instincts, survival-based biological instincts. But at the same time, I believe that we all have an instinct to heal, an instinct to heal and to move towards wholeness, which is also an instinct. It's not an instinct in the same way that a fight or flight and freeze is, but it is an instinct. And I think when therapists are trying to help people erase their trauma memories or change their trauma memories, I think that it's a mistake, because we don't cure people. We help them elicit those inner instincts, those drives to wholeness, to transformation, that are as strong as any of the other instincts that I often talk about. And again, when I wrote Waking the Tiger, there was really nothing about that. Actually, if you can believe it, at that time there was one other book on trauma, and that was a book by Judith Herman called Trauma and Recovery. It's a very important book even to today. And so, again, I was talking about things that just weren't being talked about. And as I continued to explore, my thinking evolved, like you were mentioning, in an unspoken voice. I really take it to the next iteration, going from Waking the Tiger to an unspoken voice, and then eventually to trauma and memory. And again, these were all ways in which, piece by piece, I dissected, resected, synthesized my learning over these decades, and put it in a form which was scientifically based, clinically based. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I was kind of a little bit amused when we talked about the instincts or the anima as being, or the instincts being the anima as being this deep, deep feminine. And in working with different archetypes over the years, in studying some archetypes in different cultures, and also in so-called primitive cultures, where they really honor those inner knowings. And again, when I was teaching at Hopi, and then meeting some of the Navajo people, and how they took the when the code talkers, these were people who, during the Second World War, and not just Navajo, but the ones that are most known are Navajo, where they would have one. Navajo language is an unwritten language; it's only a spoken language. So if you had one Navajo person at one base and another one at another base, they could communicate with each other through that language, which would then be translated. And the Germans couldn't break that code because, again, it was unwritten. So if it weren't, in a way, with those code talkers, there could have been the world could have turned out to be very, very different. Germany very likely, or very possibly, could have won the war. And so anyhow, when they returned, and their life was threatened, if there was any chance of them being captured, the American troops were told to kill them, and they also had cyanide pills that would have to ingest if there was any chance of them being caught, because then they could translate. They couldn't translate. So when I watched some of their rituals, I was invited to observe, well, to participate and observe. What they were showing, what I saw with them, what I learned from them, is very similar to what I was seeing with my clients. Not just people from, not the, just people with war trauma, but with all kinds of different kinds of trauma, that there was a way, a nonverbal way, a body-oriented way of working with these people that was beyond words, was beyond the words. And again, that was the motivation for an unspoken voice, how the body releases trauma and restores goodness. Because the body speaks its own language. In Germany, in German, the book is called Sprecher ohne Worte, speaking without words. And this was again a really important part in my development as a therapist and in developing somatic experiencing as a body of work, as I mentioned, which is taught now in 44 countries.
And there was a description in the autobiography of trauma about that ceremony, that there was one detail that really stuck with me, where the healing leader was counting backwards the years of the soldier's life. And I'm thinking, like, as he said, maybe he said 26, the soldier's body would begin to process and release whatever had happened at 26, which is so different from what I understand about Western psychotherapy, where we really have to talk about it, dig it up, analyze it, process it. So what's your understanding of what's happening when he says a number and the body responds in towards goodness in that way?
So this, let's say this, the soldier was 26 when they're returning from the war. And so they would be with drumming, and the Navajo did use some catalysts. I think they used peyote. And not all ceremonies were done with peyote. And then there was a fire in the middle of the Hogan. The Hogan is the typical dwelling, but also where the spiritual work was done. And the door faces to the east. And so again, there were a number of people from the tribe, including the medicine man, the shaman, and they would be beating drums. And as they were beating drums, he would instruct the returning soldier to walk around the fire. And for each time around the fire, it would go back one year more. So going around the first time at 20, age of 25, then the age of 24, and all the way back until in utero. And nothing was said. Like you said, there was no attempt to understand, to analyze, to describe. But the shaman, as I read what the shaman was doing, the shaman was reading the body. And so he knew every time he was hitting into a time in his life where there was some significant trauma. And it seemed like then the drums would increase in intensity and people would start chanting. And then this would go on all night long. Finally, at the end of the ceremony, the soldier would go through the door and look to the east, would go outside, and then would regurgitate, would vomit. And then that was the healing. Before that, the soldier was not returned to his family or to the village or to the tribe, because they knew, again, intuitively, that if they did this while they were traumatized, that that trauma would be spread to the family, to the children, to the wife, to the other villagers. And so they had this very important ritual to really facilitate the healing. And what I mentioned in that chapter also is there was a program in the Army Hospital in Long Island. I forget the name of the hospital. where the soldiers returning from World War II would come to spend some weeks there. And they would, let's see if I remember. Oh, yeah. So first of all, they would interview the soldiers, and they were under the influence of a drug called sodium pentothal. That's the so-called truth serum, but it's not. It, in a way, it has some similar effects to MDMA, that it allows the person to stand back and look at some of the events of what happened to them and just to not get swept away by it. So this went on for some time, and they call this narcotherapy, narco-hypnotherapy, something like that. And then they would come together as a group, and they would play sports like baseball and volleyball, and they were, again, reintegrating with themselves. And then, and only then, were the family members invited in. And then, and such an And by the way, this was filmed. You can actually watch it if you go to John Huston, Let There Be Light. So Huston was contracted by the army to make a movie of this program. And but then afterwards, the army stamped it confidential, secret, top secret, because they were afraid that if people realized that they could be traumatized, they wouldn't enlist. But rather, it showed that even when you have to deal with the horrors of war, there was healing. So, but anyhow, they put stamp confidential on it. So a group of us tried to, we had heard about it, and we filed a Freedom of Information Act, from the government. And around that time, it was released anyhow. And it's really inspiring to see this. I recommend it. Again, you can go, it's on YouTube, John Huston, Let There Be Light. So again, there were these things that really worked, that really helped people heal. And so instead, they, have these things where they have people relive their traumas over and over again, called prolonged exposure therapy, or help people to change their negative thoughts, or to manage, with psychiatric drugs and so forth. And I'm afraid this is so far behind what was available in 1940, 50, I think it was 1950, 1946, 1948, 1950, with a program like this at the Army Hospital. And it saddens me that we don't take the healing of trauma as absolutely essential for us to have functioning societies, because trauma spreads. It spreads like a virus, and unless we will attend to it, it will infect all of us, those around us. So
Yeah, I mean, when I look at our culture, I think it was a quote from Rezma Menakem, who wrote Grandmother's Hands, that trauma, when generalized to a population, looks like culture.
right.
And one of the reasons my family and I moved from the U.S. to Spain, it's not that maybe there certainly is a history of trauma in Europe and in Spain, and in Catalonia, where I am, there's still very vivid memories of the civil war and the
Revolution.
fascists. But if it's like it's other people's trauma, you can kind of see it. But swimming in the U.S. and you point out that compared to, say, Germany, the U.S. is very people. Our culture is very reluctant to look at things that we have done, to look at things that we have transgressed.
To the blacks, to the Indian, the First Nations people. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and, my daughter and I talk almost daily about what's going on in Gaza, as Jews, and we're, the additional trauma of, the trauma of witnessing the horrific cruelty and death, coupled with the trauma of being ostracized from a community, I think like healing trauma, like maybe that's all that we can, like everything else is counteractive. Everything else is like, disputing your thoughts, but the your that's why your work has had such appeal to me, because it feels like it's a way to begin to stem the tidal waves that
Right.
just keep recurring.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking, absolutely heartbreaking. Many years ago, this was before the last Intifada, so it must have been 30 years ago. I was teaching a workshop, a training in Jerusalem. And part of what I asked them to agree with is that they would also invite people from who worked in mental health in Gaza. And so and there were more Israelis there, more Jewish people there, but there were a number of people from Gaza Mental Health. And so I teach often by demonstration. I'll demonstrate with a work with a person and then talk about it, describe it. People can ask questions. And so I was working with this one volunteer, this man named Chaim Dasburg. And somebody asked me, it's a typical question, well, what if you don't know what the trauma is? Can you work with it? I said, oh, yes, of course. All you need is a symptom or some kind of a haunting. That's all you need. And so this man volunteered, asked to work with me. And again, he had had severe back pain for 30 years. For 30 years. And it was interesting because he recognized it as occurring at a specific date, a specific time. So anyhow, as I'm working with him, non-verbally, he just starts sweating profusely. And his body starts trembling and vibrating in the waves of easy, deep breaths. And at the end, he opens his eyes and he looks around. And you could see astonishment on his face. And he was astonished because he wasn't feeling the pain anymore. The pain had vanished. And then we found out later, he was an army doctor. He was assigned with a troop. They were ambushed and they were all killed. And he fell out of the truck on his back into a ditch. And from that moment on, he had those back pains. So it was clear that everybody in the class was touched. And I asked if anybody would want to share a little bit with Chaim what they felt, what they noticed in their own experience. And after a while, this woman, I remember her, tall woman with like a three-piece business suit. She was a therapist, a psychologist at Gaza Mental Health. And she said, Chaim, when you volunteered to work with Dr. Levine, I was praying that something horrible would happen to you, that you would be re-traumatized, because your people have traumatized my people, have humiliated my people, have killed my people, have tortured my people. So I just had nothing but hatred. But something happened and I can't explain it. But all of a sudden, I felt such deep compassion for you and for us. And I realized, Chaim, that until we find peace within ourselves, we'll never find peace with each other. And I was just deeply moved by that observation, by her observation. And I'm afraid that we see instead these things repeating and repeating and repeating. And they will continue to repeat. And the children of Gaza, who are now 4, 5, 6 years old, in 10 years, they'll be the next Hamas because they're carrying that trauma with them. And again, it's so deeply disturbing to me because I know there's a different way that we don't have to keep repeating these traumas over and over and over, but we have to take the healing of trauma seriously and attend to it as we would attend to any epidemic like COVID. because is destructive, and no, is more destructive than COVID. And many people actually experience an increase in their trauma during the period of isolation for COVID. So I guess I'm not sure exactly where I'm going with this, except that we have to take trauma seriously and really, really work at many different levels for its healing.
I'm curious, given that you've been teaching this for 50 years now, and I guess I'm looking for an optimistic response after this discussion. I'm wondering if you've noticed that this like more interest, or that the students you have who are now in their 20s and 30s, is there some good news about where we're going in the midst of all the
Yeah.
headlines?
Oh, I think there is good news. Actually, one of the things I say when I'm asked a question like that is I say, well, the bad news is that trauma is a fact of life. The good news is that trauma doesn't have to be a life sentence. Given the right tools, trauma won't rule. We can heal. We can not only heal, but we can be more vibrant, more alive, more confident. And and as I say, without these tools, trauma does rule. But with the right tools and with the right support and the right guidance, then I mean, I have no question that trauma does not have to be a life sentence, that it can be healed. And not only can it be healed, but it can be transformed. And the transformation of trauma opens in often to different kinds of what would be previously called spiritual experiences, but they are spiritual openings, doors that open when we heal from our traumas. It's not just we erase the trauma, but we open to different spiritual dimensions.
Well, and one thing I don't want to leave without talking about is, your autobiography of trauma. So, I projected onto you sort of this, peaceful, wise guy. I thought the worst trauma was the car accident that you talked about in an unspoken voice, where this woman kind of got your body to relax so you were able to process, and then. Trigger warning to my listeners. This gets pretty deep. You talk about being raped.
That's right. Yeah, what was
yeah, go ahead.
my family was threatened by the mafia. If my father was, long story, but I do talk about it in the autobiography. If my father would testify against the mafia, which was led by Johnny Dioguardo, he was featured in The Goodfellas and The Irishman. He was one of the most murderous of all of the, those people. And so our family was threatened that if my father testified, in his words, they would find his family face down in the East River. In other words, we would have been killed. So, as part to secure our silence, I was raped by some of these mafia people. And that I would, the idea was that I would tell my parents about this so they would know how serious they were. But I never told them about it. In a way, I never even told it to myself until in developing somatic experiencing, I was having these strange symptoms. And I, Chiron is from Greek mythology, is the wounded healer. I realized it was time for me to take a dose of my own medicine. And I had one of my students guide me through these symptoms in which I healed from that horrible rape, but also self-compassion about how it was for the family, because we knew something was wrong. It was never talked about, and that was in some ways more problematic even than the rape, that it was completely a void, silence. But we knew something was wrong because every week or two, these lawyers, I think they were probably sent there by the mafia, by DiGuardo, And they would instruct my parents. I thought they were there to help, but they basically were there to make sure that they didn't testify. And so this combination of the violence of the rape and not having the support in the family, together, those really took away my spirit. But again, thankfully, with the help of one of my students, I was able to recover this and to move forward in my life.
Yeah, so I mean, as I was reading and thinking about it, things like that would have been, I'm imagining, have been very hard to disclose in a book, but even but you go further, it's sort of in the tradition of a lot of like psychotherapists and psychologists, sort of Jung and R.D. Lang and others, to be like so open about your own shame.
Yes,
And I'm curious, okay, so for a personal memoir that's going to sit in your bedside drawer is one thing. But one of the first things you write is that in telling my story, I hope I to encourage you to tell yours.
yes.
And I'm thinking, when I read that, I thought about my mother, a Holocaust survivor, who told her story incessantly to everyone, but it was never a healing story. It was a
Yes.
story of victimhood and anger.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like as you decided to share this with the world, these really deeply vulnerable moments, these
Yeah.
moments in which you cringe at the things you had said and done.
Yeah.
What was the purpose for you, both in doing it and in inviting a response from the reader, a similar response?
Well, again, that was the idea. To really help people with their own healing and to encourage them to write their own stories, because we all have beautiful stories to tell, beautiful stories. And in somatic experiencing, we don't go right for the core of a trauma. We work around the periphery. And for example, so rather than go in the book, I talk about something so that I could feel it fully in my body, of something that happened where I really felt cared for. And this was my fourth or fifth birthday. And in the nighttime, my parents went into my bedroom and laid tracks, modeled railroad tracks underneath the bed, out into the room, back down again, and then back into the, and then also again back underneath the bed. And so when I awoke, the train was going around the track. The sound of the train and I just totally jumped out of bed. My whole body felt alive. I felt cared for. I felt loved. I wasn't using those words, but that was the feeling. And so, as I really connected to that in my body, that gave me the platform where I could begin to access the traumatic events of the rape and the situation in the family, without being overwhelmed, because the important is not to overwhelm the person, because in terms of the nervous system, it can't really tell the difference between being overwhelmed and having the original trauma. So it's really important that we don't go right into the trauma. And there were a couple of memories like that which really brought my body back to life. Somebody asked, how do you know if a session is successful? I say, because the person feels more alive. They feel more alive and real and connected and in the here and now, in the present time. It's not about remembering. It's not about reliving. It's about living. I never thought of it that way. And not reliving, it's about living. Yeah.
Living, not reliving.
That's right. Thank you. I'm going to quote us on that one.
Well, and there's a whole section about your mentors, these wise women who helped
Oh
you,
God, yeah.
who are around sort of body awareness and spirituality, and then this group of men who are these physicists and scientists. And I was really struck, and I sent this quote to my daughter. It's about Ilya Prigozhin's work on dissipative structures and the conclusions of negative entropy. And she said, like, I started reading that sentence thinking that I would not understand another word, and then I continued to quote So it opened a portal into my understanding of titration, slowly and gently introducing only the right amount of trauma stimuli to regulate the nervous system. With proper dosage, the poison is the cure. And I was so grateful for you to make that connection between, these fundamental laws of physics and this deep, squishy, messy work of being a human being, working with human beings.
Right there, that I think they're a chapter with two subsections. One is called The Most Important Women in My Life, and that was a woman called named Charlotte Selvers, who was about sensory awakening, sensory awareness in the body. A woman who did different kind of breathing therapy, Magda Proskauer. And then Ida Rolf, the toughest lady that I've ever known. And I was one of the few people that she allowed me to call her grandma. And maybe you've heard of structural integration.
I got
Oh, did you?
Rolfed.
Okay. And it's called Rolfing.
Yeah.
So,
I did 4 years of Reichian orgone therapy in
oh,
my
okay.
twenties, so
All right. Well, anyhow, with learning from these wise women. And then a fourth teacher of mine was a woman named Mira Rothenberg, and she wrote a beautiful book called The Children with Emerald Eyes. And it's about her work with psychotic and autistic children. And I learned from her and from a dog that I had how to trust my guts, how to bypass my intellectual thinking, but to really come from my instincts, from my guts. And these four women have been so influential. And then as you mentioned, there were four important men. And how important also they were in formulating in the scientific intellectual part. So again, those teachers were both sensing, knowing, feeling mentors, and also intellectual scientific mentors. And the book kind of goes back and forth between the felt sense, the knowing body, and different theoretical physics and mathematics, a branch of mathematics called catastrophe theory. So, one of the questions I asked myself is, how was it that I was so fortunate to being taken under the wing of these teachers? What was it that brought me to them, and in a way, them to me? And I really pondered this and meditated this. And I think it has, if more than anything, had to do with karma, that I was supposed to meet these teachers, and that they then took me underneath their collective wing. Kind of an amusing story about Dr. Ida Rolf, Dr. Rolf. As I mentioned, I was one of the few people that she allowed me to call her grandma. Well, anyhow, I was visiting her in New York City. I was at her apartment in Manhattan, and she took me out to a restaurant. It was a Jewish deli that was right in the neighborhood, and we were having dinner, and she was going on and on, absolutely correctly, how lucky I was to have her take me under her wing. And again, I nodded my head in agreement. But then, as we were leaving the restaurant, we passed a table, and there was an old Jewish couple. And they said to her, they said to Ida Rolf, to Dr. Rolf, "You know, you're so lucky to have such a wonderful grandsons." And she couldn't get the words out, but we smiled at each other. And then began the beginning of a 2-year relationship.
And yeah, I love how you embrace this idea of karma of a, it's like I've done lots of stuff, and as I think about it, like it's almost like an invitation for me to claim my own, like this isn't like decisions I've made, or it isn't entitlement, or it isn't luck or random. And
No.
it feels so much more powerful to kind of look back on my history, on the people that I met. How I found you was because my wife got a book on Audible that I had no interest in, and I had run out of books, so I started listening, and it was The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk, and it talks about your work. And like that, I had already been doing coaching, and that kind of blew my mind. And then I discovered memory reconsolidation and Stephen Hayes' work on relational frame theory and language. And it's like all of this, it feels like accidents that could just as easily not have happened.
And the accidents are not accidents, as I learned. But again, those are coming together. Those are synchronicities. Those are trance meetings, not chance meetings, but trance meetings that somehow we were brought together to meet and to carry this work forward. So I thank you for allowing me to speak to you and your audience. And I'm going to sign off right now. I've got to meet with somebody in a little bit.
Can
And
I ask you one quick question?
sure. Go ahead.
If people want to follow your work, there's the Autobiography of Trauma by Peter A. Levine. If they want to study with you or learn more, where do they go?
They go to the somatic experiencing, one word, somaticexperiencing.com website, and that takes you to all of my books and all of, my events and so forth, but also to the Somatic Experiencing International Training Center, which is in Colorado, and it also connects to there. So if people want to find therapists trained in SE, or find trainings, they can go there. So I would, again, just recommend going to somaticexperiencing.com website, and that information is there.
Great. All right. Dr. Peter Levine, thank you so much. I feel like this is one of the reasons I started this podcast 14, 11 years ago to have this conversation. Thank you for all you do and for taking the time today.
Okay. Well, glad to have met you.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Hasta luego. Ciao, ciao.
And that's a wrap. Find the show notes with links to the books we talked about and the names of many of the people it might be hard to figure out how to spell, like Ilya Prigozhin and Charlotte Selver and Mira Rothenberg. Find all that at the show notes at plantyourself.com/581. So I've been doing a lot of boxing lately. Arms are sore and tired. What else? Played paddle again for the first time in several weeks. I got new sunglasses that are actually sports glasses, and it really helped. It turns out that being able to see the ball can actually improve your game. Who knew? Also, beach running, did some stairs, and I gotta say, my knee is feeling better. My ankle and knee, which were really troubling me, they still crack like a castanet band every time I walk around, but they haven't given me pain, and they haven't been feeling like they've been slowing me down, stopping me, or making me wary. But of course, no running on anything other than grass for the last couple of months, which may help as well. So I think that's about it for me. We are now fully ensconced. We've been here a month in our new apartment, much quieter, more spacious. You can see a little bit if you watch the YouTube video of this podcast, you'll be able to see my new lighting setup and a plain white wall behind me where I put up an old bed headboard just to give it some sound treatment so it's not quite so cave-like and echoey. But things are moving apace, and looking forward to the Barcelona spring. So as always, be well, my friends. All right, time for thanks. Thanks to Will Ridenour for allowing me to use his beautiful song, Sabali Dawn, The Dance of Peace. You can find more of Will's music at his website, willridenour.com. And of course, thanks to all of you Plant Yourself Podcast patrons.
Kim Harrison, Lynn McClellan, Brittany Porter, Dominic Maurer, Barbara Whitney, Tammy Black, Amy Good, Amanda Hatherley, Mary Jane Wheeler, Ellen Kennelly, Melissa Cobb, Rachel Behrens, Tina Scharf, Tina Ahern, Jen Filkinowski, David Bizek, The Mysterious Michelle X, Elsbeth Feldman, Leah Stoller, Alan Christensen, Colleen Peck, Michelle Landry, Josina, Sarah Durkis, Kelly Cameron, Janet Selby, Claire Adams, Tom Franzek, Jeanette Benham, Gila Sert, David Donahue, Blair Cyber, Dorona Vizov, Gio and Carolyn Argentati, Jody Friesner, Misha Rosen, Michael Warbeck, Aviva Lael, Alicia Lemus, Val Linneman, Nick Harper, Bandana Chawley, Molly Levine, The Inscrutable Harry R., Susan Laverty, The Panda Vegan, Craig Kovic, Adam Scharf, Karen Burry, Heather Morgan, Nigel Davies, Marion Blum, Teresa Koppel, Julian Watkins, Breed O'Connell, Sharon Hirschman, Linda Ayad, Holm Hedegaard, Iza Tuzinwa, Connie Hainline, Aaron Greer, Alicia Davis, Heather O'Connor, Carolyn Jensen, Sherry Lakoski of Plant Power for Health, Karen Smith, Scott Marani, Karen and Joe Crabtree, Kirby Burton, Teresa Carell, Kevin McCauley, Elizabeth Rothschild, Aunt Jessie, Cheryl Dwyer, Jenny Hazelton, Peter W. Evans, Dennis Bird, Darby Kelly, Lori Fanny, Linnea Lundquist, Emily Iaconelli, Levy Wallach, Rosamund McAtee, Dan Picorni, Stephen Leenan, Patty DiMartino, Mike and Donna Kartz, Deanne Bishop, Bilberry Elf, Marjorie Lewis, Trisha Adams, Nancy Sheldon, Lindsay Bayshore, Gunmarit Hagen, Tracy Gullidge, Laura Heaton, Meg from Mama Says, Stacey Stokes, Ben Savage, Michael Kay, David Hughes, Connie Rogers, Claire England, Sally Robertson, Paranganchi, Amy Daly, Brian Tourville, Mark Jeffrey Johnson, Josie Dempsey, Karen Schmidt, Pamela Hayden, Emily Perryman, Allison Corbett, Richard Stone, Lauren Vaught of Edible Musings, Aaron Hasty, Sean Owen, Sagar Nayak, Erica Piedra, Danielle Roberts, Michael Lushton, Sarah Johnson, Catherine Floyd, for your generous support of the podcast. That's it for now. As always, be well, my friends.